From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Global markets opened down today in response to President Trump's promise to impose steep tariffs on imports, 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum. Europe's largest home appliance maker, Electrolux, protested that announcement today by putting a hold on its planned $250 million plant expansion in Tennessee. Let's get the global perspective with the BBC's international business correspondent, Theo Leggett, in London. And Theo, what are you hearing in Europe?
The reaction in Europe has been that this is seen as naked protectionism. The president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, issued a statement in which he said that there was no justification, really, on security grounds for Mr. Trump to do what he's done, and that therefore the European Union would be considering its response and would be preparing to launch consultations at the World Trade Organization in Geneva.
Well, what would a response look like if we are, in fact, staring down a trade war?
Well, we don't exactly know what a response will be because we don't know the details of what the Trump administration is planning, whether in this broad policy in imposing 25% tariffs on steel imports, 10% on aluminium, there's any leeway, whether there's any exemptions or allowances made. But the EU has made it clear that if European exports are affected, it expects to take the matter up in the World Trade Organization. Now, the World Trade Organization has set procedures for this kind of thing with specific time periods set out for each stage. And the chances are that would take quite a long time, probably more than a year. That's how long it tends to take. At the end of that, the World Trade Organization itself could authorize the European Union and other countries, Canada might take a similar route, to introduce sanctions of their own on exports of U.S. products.
And just remind us, how much steel, how much aluminum is being imported from Europe to the United States?
Europe isn't one of the biggest suppliers to the U.S. I mean, the United States gets most of its imported steel from Canada, Brazil, South Korea. Germany is the biggest exporter of both products. It ships 1.4 million tons or thereabouts of steel to the US every year. So that puts it in the top 10. But here's the thing. What producers in Europe are worried about is that if exports are not going to the United States, they're going to end up on European markets. They're going to depress prices in Europe and lead to even greater oversupply than we've already got. Now, in recent years, a lot of steel mills across Europe have had to close down. That's caused an awful lot of industrial unrest, big political protests. It has become a major issue. Much as you have in the United States with steel workers worried about their jobs, people here are worried about their jobs too. So that's the real worry here. Not so much the loss of markets in the United States, but the effect that the US sanctions will have on the European market and on European jobs.
Now, the names of the countries that you've mentioned so far in this conversation are worth noting. Germany and Canada, these are our friends in the United States. How remarkable is it, from your perspective there in Europe, that these tariffs would be going after American allies?
The reason it's causing a certain amount of, if not surprise, because we've known that this is kind of the way Donald Trump was going for some time, maybe bemusement, is because it doesn't seem to have a lot of benefit for the United States if it's going to offend its key trading partners. A lot of European businesses do business in the United States. American businesses do business in Europe and in Southeast Asia. The risk is if you get into any sort of tit-for-tat, retaliation, even a trade war, then it's those businesses which stand to lose out. They may be friendly nations, but if companies are making losses, then there will be a lot of political friction. And companies which were thinking about investing in the United States, for example, might think twice about it, might look for other markets.
Does the international community buy the argument that the White House is making that these tariffs will help protect American national security?
From what I've seen, not at all. I mean, I'll refer you back to that statement by Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission. He says there is no security criteria which could lead you to say that you wouldn't bring imports from Europe into the United States. Potentially, there could be an argument made about imports from China. But again, The UK steel industry has said the same thing, that there is no security rationale here. There is plenty of steel in the United States, and the US steel producers are still strong enough to supply the needs of the US defense industry if they had to. So the impression outside of the United States is that this is naked protectionism, that there is no security rationale for it. But whether that'll wash with the Trump administration is open to question. I'd imagine his arguments go down pretty well in the U.S. steel belt.
Naked protectionism is something that President Trump had promised the American people when he was elected. Is it any wonder that people are taken aback by this policy?
Well, I think in the rest of the world, maybe people had hoped that there was more rhetoric than substance to what Donald Trump was doing. We now know that he is willing to go through with what he says he's going to do. So earlier this year, for example, we had sanctions imposed on things like washing machines and solar panels from China and South Korea.
Right.
I think the bemusement is that this is, on the face of it, a very sweeping measure. The rationale behind it is far from clear. And although it may go down very well with Donald Trump's electorate, it does risk upsetting businesses around the world, and it risks causing genuine economic harm.
That's the BBC's Theo Leggett in London. Theo, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Well, severe weather is hitting both coasts of the United States today. In Northern California, a major storm is dumping snow and triggering avalanche warnings, while the southern part of California is experiencing flash floods and mudslides. And this comes after the state saw one of the driest winters on record. On the other side of the nation, a nor'easter with rains and wind up to 70 miles per hour has led to the cancellation of more than 2,000 flights. Joining us now with more is Dr. Greg Postel, hurricane and storm specialist for the Weather Channel. And Greg, let's start with California. Where did this storm come from, especially since it seems like it's been such a dry winter there?
Yeah, it has. The pattern has kind of taken a dramatic shift. Now we're starting to get storm systems coming in from the North Pacific and even areas farther north than that come down the west coast of North America and have now impacted parts of California, bringing lots of rain, mountain snows in particular, because these systems have cold air aloft with them. They're so effective at producing snow at the higher elevations of the Sierras in California, for example.
Yeah, so on the one hand, all that added precipitation is good if you've been experiencing a drought. But on the other, as we're seeing avalanche warnings, flash flood warnings. I mean, who's getting hardest hit and what are the impacts in California?
Well, likely in the Sierra are the hardest hit regions. And the problem is it's too much of a good thing at once.
Yeah,
I mean, where they've been arguably a drought for so long, correct? And it just seems like that it's all coming at once. And sometimes the earth can't handle all of that. And we end up with flooding and mudslides and the like. And that's unfortunately one of the symptoms of the system that we're going to be dealing with for the next couple of days.
Right. So let's switch over then to the eastern United States and the nor'easter there. How big is that storm?
Well, it's huge, and that's one of the problems that is we're going to be dealing with is the size of the storm, because it is helping to create very huge waves, and the coastal flooding threat is perhaps one of the more significant aspects of this because of its sort of large size and the circulation just spiraling over the Atlantic Ocean, bringing in very high water marks to parts of the Northeast. And in addition to that, strong winds as well over a large area, in part because the storm is so big, all the way from New England to the mid-Atlantic and the Carolinas, with damaging wind gusts throughout today and tonight.
So strong winds and high seas means lots of flooding danger, right?
Lots of flooding danger. Coastal flooding is going to be a significant problem throughout the high tide cycles, not just today, but probably over the weekend as well. And that's one of the sort of aspects or the legacies of this storm is how long it's going to be sort of sticking around, so to speak, because over multiple high tide cycles, we're going to get significant flooding across parts of the Northeast with the storm surge component added to the high tides leading to all those flooding issues.
Wow. So specifically then, do we know when it might end, when the storms might end?
Well, the worst of the weather, the rain and the snow, should be off the coast by tomorrow morning. But the large size of the circulation, the fact that it's slow moving over the North Atlantic, means we're going to continue to deal with some wind impacts tomorrow, not as strong as today. But still on Saturday, it could be quite windy up and down the East Coast with definitely some big waves. And again, at those times of astronomical high tides, we have to watch out for the possibility or the likelihood of significant coastal flooding.
Oh, boy. One last question. I mean, you've said that this is a really huge storm. Any particular reason why? Is it unusually large?
Well, it is unusually large. There's no doubt about that. But probably one of the more irritating effects of the whole event is the fact that it's not moving very much. The jet stream is in a very peculiar position over the North Atlantic. We're sort of in a blocked phase, meaning it's not freely flowing from west to east like it often does. And so this storm, once it's offshore, as it is today, it just won't be able to move very much. It's like a traffic jam over the western North Atlantic. And so it's just going to continue to sit and spin and continue to bring those impacts for longer than many storms in the past.
Wow. Well, that's the Weather Channel's Greg Postel bringing us details on some wild weather from California all the way to the Northeast. Thanks so very much.
My pleasure. Take care.
An NPR Ipsos poll out today shows that three-quarters of people polled think gun laws should be stricter than they are now. Gun control advocates call it a potential watershed moment that could diminish the powerful gun lobby. But it's not clear what, if any, federal changes will come out of last month's school shooting in Florida. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Shannon Watts, a Colorado mother of five, says she watched in stunned frustration as nothing happened on gun control at the federal level after the Sandy Hook school massacre. 20 children and 6 adults were murdered. And again, in mass shooting after mass shooting, nothing. Now Watts says Parkland is different. She says with the help of activist students, more people are using their voices and votes to start to crack the power of the NRA.
They have money on their side, but now we have momentum and a grassroots army. And they don't even know what's coming their way at the midterms. It won't be pretty.
That momentum, Watts says, includes more than 1.5 million new people since Parkland who've signed on with Moms Demand Action, the group she founded after Sandy Hook. And President Trump this week, in an extraordinary meeting, seemed to embrace new gun restrictions that many thought unimaginable just a few weeks ago. Trump reiterated his support for NRA-backed ideas of training and arming some teachers. But Trump said Parkland had changed the debate. In a bipartisan meeting Wednesday, he signaled support for wide-ranging gun control measures the gun lobby fiercely opposes, including significantly expanding background checks to cover online sales and firearms bought at gun shows.
And they have to be strong. The background checks, hey, look, I'm the biggest fan of the Second Amendment. Many of you are. I'm a big fan of the NRA, but I had lunch with them, with Wayne and Chris and David on Sunday, and said, it's time. We got to stop this nonsense. It's time.
But underscoring the might and access of the gun lobby, the NRA's top lobbyist Chris Cox met in the Oval Office with the president and Vice President Mike Pence last night. Cox tweeted afterwards that Trump and Pence, quote, support the Second Amendment, support strong due process, and don't want gun control. Shortly after, the president tweeted, good, great meeting in the Oval Office tonight with the NRA. And Republican leader Mitch McConnell also signaled he has no plans to bring a gun measure to the Senate next week. Taken together, gun control advocates worry the president's embrace of new gun measures will prove fleeting. Still, since Parkland, more than a dozen corporations, from car rental to giant chain stores, have stopped offering discounts or special offers to NRA members or have significantly changed their gun sales policies. And anecdotally anyway, some gun owners are breaking with the NRA, arguing that the gun lobby's absolutist approach to the Second Amendment is unrealistic. Peggy Criscio, a Connecticut hairdresser, calls herself a proud gun owner, Second Amendment supporter, and former NRA member. She doesn't have a problem with expanding background checks and waiting periods at gun shops and gun shows. Again, all restrictions the NRA opposes.
No, they don't represent me at all. There needs to be restrictions on these assault rifles, especially if this is happening in our schools. I mean, something has to be done. I don't think arming teachers is going to help. I don't think that's their responsibility.
Criscio owns an AR-15, similar in style to the semi-automatic rifle used in scores of massacres, including Parkland. She got it, she says, to feel its power at the shooting range.
But once you have it and realize that it can change a person's life forever, such as a child, you think twice about owning one.
She's now thinking about donating her AR-15 to local law enforcement. But Dr. Arthur Prishbinda, with the group Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership and an NRA member, says this backlash is fueling a gun rights counterpunch.
I think what we're seeing is a greater interest in supporting gun rights. Nobody joins the NRA for the free cap. They join it because they feel that the NRA is the best agent to defend their Second Amendment rights.
Meantime, gun control advocates are waiting to see if Trump's rhetorical support for expanded background checks and other new federal measures translates into real action, or is merely another mercurial head fake from a president who has made unpredictability central to his presidency. Real change may come at the state level. For Here and Now, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And in fact, this week Rhode Island became the latest to allow authorities to take guns away from people who are at risk of being violent. Five other states have already had these red flag laws on the books, and more are considering them after the Florida shooting. Indiana's Attorney General Curtis Hill told President Trump about his state's red flag law during a meeting last week at the White House.
It gets us past the issue of the person's mental illness. We address the taking of the guns. We get them in court. They're allowed to have their day in court. But in the meantime, we're able to cool down this process and take the guns from someone.
Now, supporters say laws like this might have prevented the Parkland shooting. So let's bring in Kimball Richardson. He's a licensed mental health counselor with Community Health Network in Indianapolis. Kimball, welcome.
Thank you so much.
These red flag laws are a little bit different in every state. How does it work where you are in Indiana?
It works in Indiana such that a police officer can either search and or seize a weapon if they believe a person is at imminent risk for harming themselves or other people, and the person either has a mental illness and has not been taking their medication appropriately or following treatment protocols, or there's evidence that suggests the person might be violent and emotionally unstable.
Let's talk about that evidence. From your perspective as a mental health worker, I mean, is there a time when you feel it is the appropriate time to invoke this law? What does it look like? How do you know?
Well, we had a situation where that happened recently. A citizen called a hotline and said, I'm having thoughts of killing myself and I'm in a storage area and I have a gun. So the person working on the hotline called the police. The police went out and found the person. The person was not in a storage area. They were actually in their car, but they were close to a storage area so that they were then able to, with probable cause and with prosecutor's consent, invoke – we call it here in Indiana the Jake Laird Law after – one of our Indianapolis Metropolitan Police officers died.
I'll just tell that story quickly. This was in 2005. The law was passed. A mentally ill man killed a police officer. Now, he had his guns taken away when he was committed in an emergency situation, but then was able to get those guns back and then subsequently killed the officer. So, you know, that's the fascinating thing about what's happened in Indiana. It's a very conservative state. It's very gun friendly. One in three adults I see own a gun in Indiana, and yet this law passed easily through the legislature. What does that say to you?
Well, I think that they listened to the fact that one of our public safety professionals had to lose his life. This didn't have to happen. And the right people were behind it, I think, and the timing was right. I think this was a common sense issue. We've probably, since the law has been enacted in 2005, at least in the Indianapolis area, have used it about 800 times, I understand.
Unlike most other states, Indiana does not require a judge's order. A police officer can just take this gun.
Well, initially that can happen, but they do have to file the appropriate paperwork so that the judge can then determine, was this done appropriately and do we still continue to seize the weapon, or does the citizen need to have it returned?
So there aren't concerns about due process and whether or not someone would have that gun taken away who didn't deserve it.
That's right. And then, you know, even if a gun is taken away and it's found to have been for an appropriate reason and all the procedures were followed, they still have a hearing about approximately 2 weeks later. And then even if it remains in police hands, they can request another hearing in 180 days. And so they're still continuing to determine, are they able to not be violent or not hurt themselves or others? So there's lots of ways to make sure that process is appropriate.
Well, as you know, the vast majority of people who have a mental illness. They're not going to go shoot up a school. They're not going to necessarily commit murder. I mean, they may be at higher risk of suicide, for sure. But, I mean, do you think there is a risk that laws like these, as they become more popular or more considered around the country, that they would target people who aren't truly a risk?
Well, that's why we have to have mental health professionals involved in the conversation to make sure two things. One, that mental illness is not targeted just because someone has a mental illness, because there has to be a threat. And two, to make sure that the process is followed appropriately and that we're working with law enforcement to make sure it all works in tandem.
You mentioned it's been invoked about 800 times in Indianapolis. Do you think the law has made your state safer?
Well, I'd like to think so. I do know that not all police departments use it or are even as familiar with it as we'd like them to be. So we want all law enforcement agencies to know that this is an option that they have to keep people safe.
Do you think awareness has changed since Parkland?
Yeah, absolutely it has. Yep. I believe so.
That's Kimball Richardson. He's a licensed mental health counselor with Indiana's Community Health Network. Kimball, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Markets around the world are reacting today to President Trump's plan to levy significant tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Investors are worried that the move could have a domino effect around the world, in other words, a trade war. This morning, President Trump tweeted, though, quote, "When a country is losing many billions of dollars on trade and virtually every country does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win," end quote. Well, Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She's got a podcast, too. It's called Better Off. Hi there, Jill.
Hello.
How well thought out do you think this tariff is?
Not really at all. And frankly, to hear the word war is really never good. So I'm not sure what the president's talking about. And of course, this is coming, right now on the heels of a nasty losing month for stock investors. You know, February was the worst month for stocks in 2 years. And of course, the month that saw the first market correction in 2 years. And so, you know, I know indexes aren't down so much today, but, you know, if we get another day of selling today, it's going to make people a little anxious before the weekend.
Well, it does seem as if this announcement has caught many people around the world, let alone the United States, off guard. But to give the president the benefit of the doubt, he says he wants to help Americans who have been left behind by global free trade policies. So who in the United States, you know, could benefit from these tariffs?
You know, obviously a U.S. steel or aluminum manufacturer would do well under this, even the rough sketch of it. Nucor, U.S. Steel, those share prices in those companies up about 5 to 7% yesterday. Investors are taking some of the profits today. But, you know, if you work for one of those companies, I'm sure you're feeling pretty good today.
And those people who aren't feeling pretty good are whom?
The companies that purchase steel and aluminum, so think of car manufacturers or equipment makers, construction firms, tool and die makers, manufacturers of air conditioners, also industries that use aluminum for packaging, like beer companies or canned food makers. You know, look, we don't know right now whether or not affected companies would pass on the increased cost to consumers or if the businesses themselves would be harmed enough to reduce employment. Already, the American International Automobile Dealers Association has warned it would drive prices up substantially. Again, details not clear yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, back to what the president claims in his tweet, that trade wars are good and easy to win. We have been in somewhat similar situations before where the United States was engaged in trade wars. I mean, how did they turn out?
Not good. You know, look, the retaliatory measures by a foreign country could be really damaging. And, you know, when you think about this, like a U.S. exporter could really face some challenges. If you read the papers this morning, you saw that the soybean producers, a lot of agro products, they're very concerned about the action because the fear is that a country like China might say, okay, you want to slap a tariff on our steel or aluminum? No problem. we're going to slap a tariff on your agricultural products, and that could be quite damaging, and it can escalate from there.
Okay. So, Joe, one last question. I mean, the trade war in and of itself, problematic, but to get, again, back to what I think the president's fundamental aim here is, if not tariffs, we've just got 15 seconds here, how might the U.S. support its domestic steel industry?
You know, I think we have to have fair trade, and I think that we could do a lot to get to some level playing field. But just remember, we've already done a lot of this already. You know, we saw this with China, and so we have a decade later where China's production really down here to the U.S. So we've done it before. We can do it again.
Jill Schlesinger, thanks so much.
Sure.
Later this month, student organizers from Parkland, Florida, will gather in Washington for the March of Our Lives demonstration that's expected to attract 500,000 people. They're calling for stricter gun laws after the shooting at their school that left 17 people dead. It's a political youth movement that calls others to mind. Think of the 1960s free speech movement led by students like Mario Savio at the University of California, Berkeley.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Let's take a look back at the history of youth movements in the U.S. with Nathan Connolly and Joanne Freeman. They're co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Sure. So, Joanne, let's start with you. You're the early America scholar. In those early days of the Republic, were young people protesting?
Well, they were, but there's an important difference to bear in mind. So college students, young people, did indeed protest, but students were not right now we sort of see them as pre-adults. You know, there's like children and children are protesting and then adults protest, and that's something different. And in this earlier period, although they were students, they were still kind of taking part in protest in a way that adults were too. So, for example, during the Revolutionary era, you had adults who were doing things like, you know, writing pamphlets to protest against unfair British taxes, and they were boycotting imported British goods. And college students were doing the same thing. You know, some of them were writing pamphlets. A lot of them were boycotting goods. But what's kind of wonderful about it is, on the one hand, they were acting like adults and they weren't being dismissed as, you know, you don't belong in this national public conversation, but they were glancing every once in a while at their parents while doing it. So my favorite example of that takes place actually at Yale in 1769, when the Yale senior class announced that they're going to boycott imported British clothing and cloth. And they put this in the newspaper, and they announce in the newspaper the reason why they're putting it in the press is so that their parents can see that they're doing it and can send them local cloth and local clothes. So it's like, we're going to boycott British goods. Mom, send me clothes.
Do my laundry.
Exactly. It's right along the line. So they're being welcomed in the national conversation in a way that maybe sometimes nowadays people aren't being as welcoming, but they're still students.
And I see that Yale students also fought the British in New Haven during the American Revolution. But did college students at that time yet have the reputation that they do now in the United States as being these sort of like progressive agents for change?
Well, you know, their reputation as agents of protest, I guess, grows after the revolution. During the revolution, lots of people are protesting. But it's almost as though that movement unleashes some kind of a spirit of protest on campus. And what you see in the early 19th century is college students now protesting for their own rights, you know, protesting against college authorities, protesting because they don't like the food on campus. So the language of protest, I guess, becomes sort of unleashed with the revolution, and that tails into the 19th century.
Nathan, I want to bring you in here because we're talking about students. But in the early 20th century of this country, it was actually less likely that kids would be in school and more likely that they would be actually working. So what did that look like as far as activism goes?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, kids are working shoulder to shoulder with women and men at textile plants and on cotton fields all over the country. And some of the most important labor unrest in America's history, particularly in the early part of the 20th century, sees children actually playing a central role. You have a major textile strike in Philadelphia, famously called the Mother Jones Strike or the Children's Crusade, where you have about 100,000 textile workers in Philadelphia going on strike, and some 16,000 of them are in fact children, right? And they're marching for increased wages, reductions of the work week. Again, you see children in the streets in 1912 in Lawrence, Massachusetts, the famous Bread and Roses strike, again at a textile mill. And in that case, you have, I guess you would call it an untoward episode, but not one that doesn't have sequels in American history going forward, is about 100 children trying to leave and get the word out about the strike and go to Philadelphia in February of 1912, end up getting clubbed by police at a train station, right? In front of reporters, right? So the violence against children helps to galvanize support for this movement.
I was going to ask you how they were received, because those protesters, at least in 1903, this is interesting, they marched from Philadelphia to the home of President Theodore Roosevelt in New York, and they were they had banners that demanded, "We want to go to school, not the mines." what happens when they get to the president's house, or when they're clubbed a few years later, as you say? I mean, how did the country respond to that?
Well, it's an outrage to see children being abused in any kind of moral sense. I mean, in the case of the Mother Jones strike of 03, it doesn't actually lead to the workers getting their concessions, right? They end up losing, effectively losing that strike. But progressivism as a movement is absolutely gaining speed in this period, and people are beginning to think about ways of reducing the way that children are being taken advantage of in the workplace. You actually have, leading into the 1930s, a series of conferences, and one actually held by Herbert Hoover in the White House, and you get a formal statement about child health and protection that issues 19 rights of childhood. And it's amazing, actually, when you see what some of these rights are. I mean, it's basically the right for health care, in fact, and education, saving children from moral decay. Safe schools, ironically enough, is part of this, right?
Well, and let's follow that thread further into the future. 1960s, of course, the 1960s student lunch counter sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina. 1963, the televised march in Birmingham, Alabama, huge moments in the civil rights era that were led in part by young people.
Well, that's it. I mean, because schools, as a result of children being educated, then become politicized in new and important ways. So to have children miss school, as they do in the case of Birmingham in 1963, is huge. The case of college students who are, you know, supposed to be professionalized, but the fact that they're missing parts of their education in order to change the social landscape of the South with segregation, these are extraordinarily sharp moral cries that people are hearing. And what's so important to remember about, you know, say the Birmingham cases, of course, that you have children who are also suffering under the violence of, say, you know, segregation and Jim Crow. I mean, very infamously, of course, in Birmingham, you have the four little girls who were killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in the late part of 1963. But that church was targeted precisely because students and activists were able to use the 16th Street Church as a hub for opposing segregation. And they missed school in March of that year to basically have a protest of 1,000 students that was televised. They suffered police violence that was, you know, broadcast around the country. And again, it helped to morally fix the nation on what was a very, very pressing problem.
Right.
Some of the power of what you're talking about, though, Nathan, that it sounds like is the emotional impact. I mean, just as you suggested, that these are children that are being attacked.
People pay attention to that.
Yeah, well, right. And that's a more modern idea of children as being something that grabs emotions like that.
Which is exactly what we're seeing today with the students in Florida who are, you know, making these trips to Tallahassee to march on the legislature. They're making these trips to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And the images are so striking, to have the juxtaposition of a young person next to a grizzled and skeptical lawmaker. And I think that that is also another important point, which is that these kids are often thought of as a little bit naive, ignorant of history, that what they're doing isn't going to work. I want to ask both of you what you think of that as you look at all these examples through the course of our history.
Well, the idealism of childhood and the innocence of childhood really do meet in a lot of these various events. And, you know, it bears saying that, you know, there are some points in which children are more or less active, but it absolutely is the case that when they get involved, when they're put in harm's way for political causes, people do respond. And sometimes idealism is simply seen as being the right thing to do.
Hmm. Joanne, your final thoughts? Does child activism work?
Well, I think on a certain level, yes. And I think one thing that's constant is that student protesters have a, as Nathan just put it, an idealism, an innocence, an urgency in what they're doing that I think pierces through a lot of noise. Mm. And their voices right now, I think, are being heard in a way that has pierced through this long ongoing debate. And I think that over time in the revolution, too, these young voices had an impact.
That's Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee has vetoed a bill that would have shielded the state legislature from some public records laws. News organizations sued lawmakers last year for refusing to release documents under Washington State's Public Records Act. Now that the governor has vetoed that bill, lawmakers have said they're going to work with news organizations on a compromise rather than try to override the veto. Let's understand exactly how all of this happened in Washington. And joining us to help us with that is Austin Jenkins, a reporter for the Northwest News Network in Olympia. Hi there, Austin.
Hello. Great to be here.
Okay, so the background's really important here because we had mentioned that news organizations in the state had sued the legislature under the Public Records Act. Last year, Northwest News Network was amongst those who sued, for full disclosure here. But the bill the governor just vetoed actually came after a judge's ruling. So help us understand how we got here.
Yeah, right. That judge ruled in favor of the media as it relates to records held by individual lawmakers. In fact, the judge said that the legislative leaders were in violation of the law because they had been refusing to disclose records that reporters had requested. So that happened back in January here in Thurston County, where the Capitol is located. Legislative leaders, you know, didn't appreciate that ruling and responded very quickly by introducing this bill and moving it through very quickly.
Okay, so just to be clear here, legislators were told by a court in Washington that they needed to comply with state law and disclose some records upon request from the media. They didn't like that, and so instead they wrote a bill that would have curtailed that ruling or gotten them around that?
Right. This bill would have exempted them from the voter-approved Public Records Act, the very law that the judge said they were subject to. And, you know, this is a law that is really fundamental to the sort of the fiber and the culture of this state. You know, public records, access, transparency, it's kind of in our DNA here in Washington State. So this bill it exempts them from the Public Records Act. It would have prevented the release of the past records that had been requested, the very records the judge said were being improperly withheld. But then lawmakers said, actually, what this does is it sheds some new light, some new sunlight on the legislative process, because going forward, starting in July of this year, they would have allowed the release of their calendars and communications with lobbyists, as well as final dispositions in cases of misconduct.
Okay, so they're trying to defend their efforts there. But I also understand that lawmakers pushed this bill through in 48 hours without any public debate.
The process was stunning. So we've kind of moved past the policy bill phase of our legislative session into the budget phase. This is a short election year session supposed to adjourn next Thursday. This bill pops up out of nowhere on a Wednesday. It gets a brief work session, not a formal public hearing, on a Thursday. And then it's rushed to the floor last Friday, voted out of both chambers within about 20 minutes. It happened so quickly that reporters in one chamber didn't have time to get to the other chamber before it started being debated. It had an emergency clause, meaning it would go into effect immediately and would not be subject to referendum by the public. This sparked a huge outcry. More than a dozen newspapers editorialized on the front page. The Seattle Times hasn't done a front page editorial in more than 100 years. The response over the last week was tremendous.
My eyebrows are rising higher and higher and higher on my forehead with every sentence you're uttering here, Austin. But the governor has vetoed this bill, even though it passed the legislature, both chambers of the legislature, with a veto-proof majority. So that brings us to where we are now. Why is it that the legislature has decided to rethink this rather than just override the veto?
Well, yeah, I have to believe it has something to do with the power of public opinion. and it was a dramatic moment last night because even before the governor's veto was announced, we started getting letters from legislators that they had sent to the governor saying, you know what, we made a mistake here. And they actually used that word, a mistake, and said, you should veto this. We need a do-over. and so the governor vetoed it. There were some behind-the-scenes negotiations with the newspaper publishers. The final deal is the bill gets vetoed. The legislature pledges to create a task force to work with the media and open government advocates over the next several months to try to come up with a new proposal, a redo for the 2019 legislature.
Okay. And have they given sort of a timeline then for this new task force and when a new proposal might see the light of day?
They're giving themselves 9 months.
9 months. Okay, so not 48 hours.
Not 48 hours.
Wow.
These are complicated matters.
well, exactly, right? Which is why what happened in the past several days in Washington is so perplexing. And the fact is that Washington is not unique to, in shielding legislators from some public disclosure laws. But I'm wondering, how have people around the state been reacting to all that's been going on, and have you been hearing from folks from outside Washington about all that's happened in the past couple of days?
Yeah. And I do want to just mention that lawsuit continues, by the way. There is an appeal. It'll likely go to the Washington Supreme Court. But yeah, this has galvanized people in a way that I think is unprecedented. Certainly in my 15 years covering the state capitol, the governor's office got like 20,000 phone calls and emails. They said it was unprecedented for them. These front page editorials, very significant. And what I think it is really a cautionary tale for other states and other state lawmakers who may be saying, we want to mess with transparency. Voters are pretty touchy about that, it appears.
Well, Austin Jenkins is a reporter for the Northwest News Network, speaking to us from Olympia, Washington. Austin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young's back on Monday.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.